disputes, okay? Disputes in terms of the WTO members, in terms of the trade that has happened based on, for example, contracts. The United States, where you have 135 complaints against the country and 115 complaints made by the country. Now, when you compare the U.S., 135, to the rest of the world, complaints have been leveled against the U.S. China, 39 leveled against China versus the 135, okay? So the U.S. is involved in many trade disputes. Yes, the U.S. does have a large economy and GDP, but that many complaints to be leveled against the U.S. In the larger picture shows how the U.S. is not following, fair trade practices, to say the least. So, next up, it's not an exaggeration when we describe the U.S. as using economic coercion. How does it do that? We just listed some. It does that through fines. It does that through the restriction of financial services. It does that through trade control, for example. And another one that we listed, which is probably one of the most important ones, is through dollar hegemony. And this has been seen through the way that the U.S. has actually weaponized the dollar. Okay? So these are just a few examples of what has been described as U.S. economic coercion. Now, before we move on to our guests, let's find out what's coming up in the quick take section. Mahdi Abbasian is back from reporting and joins us now.
Hi, Kata. The Chinese report accusing the U.S. of threatening the multilateral system. At the same time, there is also a notion of reglobalization that is occurring. What that is will be coming up in my quick take section.
All right, thank you very much for that, Mahdi. Looking forward to it. Let me reintroduce our guest. Kirill Rudy is a former Belarusian ambassador to China and a former economic advisor to the president of Belarus, who rejoins us. Welcome back to the program. Taking a look at some of the trade practices by the U.S., one of them has been the way that it has incentivized other companies from countries around the world when it comes to issues like subsidies. That has been apparent in a number of fields and sectors. Perhaps you can tell us about that and how that actually works against the companies from which they actually emanate from, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in other parts of the world. How do you view the U.S. Subsidies and the way that it actually uses it?
Oh, that's a very interesting question and very useful for any country. I can name several industries that are mentioned in this report. One of them is the electric vehicle, and United States provides tax credit for $7,500 if the battery, if the main components of the car are produced in Northern America, in the United States, in Canada, or in Mexico. So if you put your manufacturing in one of the three countries that have free trade agreement among each other, so you can get this tax credit. Another one is the chips, and we can see that United States provided something around $40 billion in manufacturing subsidies in semiconductors and around $11 billion, according to this report, to R&D, research and development. Another industry that quite popular and has a big support in United States is the clean energy. The government of United States provided $369 billion subsidies to these industries if around 40% of total cost of the finished product is manufactured in United States.
All right. The last thing that he mentioned there actually refers to many incentives and subsidies that were used under the Clean Energy Bill that the U.S. offered European companies that have actually relocated to the U.S., hurting the EU economy as a whole. All right, let me bring back our next guest. And that's a very important point because that's one of the ways that the U.S. is taking advantage of the war in Ukraine. Our next guest, Linji Chu Zanadu, geopolitical analyst at International Public Relations and a consultant in global strategic communication, rejoins us. Linji Chu Zanadu, welcome back. There's no ifs, ands, or buts when it comes to the America First policy. It is about America, and it's about America watching out for itself. We've mentioned how that comes at a minimum at a cost to other countries. But how can there be movements towards stopping that in order for countries' interests not to be violated?
Power is really a priority for the U.S. Obviously, it dislikes the multipolar world. and the international aspects of the globalization. So globalization itself for the Americans must be American. It is more a matter of Americanization. It is a new country, you know, also merely 200 some years of history. So the political realism still guides its foreign policy agendas. The non-material elements are normally disregarded. It is well reflected by the grasping on the dimension of the economic hegemony. So grasping itself reflects also a pathological mass psychological dysfunction, let's say, on the mass level. So chaos and the division is self-evident.
The report has pointed out that the U.S. has long used human rights and forced technology transfer as excuses to take unilateral measures against other WTO members and to abuse trade remedies. The U.S. has done this against China in particular. The U.S. forces other members to obey its foreign policy and unreasonable demands, which is why the U.S. has been described as being a bully.
We are stuck in the middle of a massive disagreement between two big economic powers, and it's a very uncomfortable place to be.
On another front, the report cites how U.S. has implemented subsidy policies on a large scale. This was evident in the Ukraine war. U.S. subsidies attracted many multinationals from Europe into relocating into the U.S. due to attractive energy subsidies. This affected European economies on a massive scale.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apposian. The Chinese report accusing the U.S. of frequently violating World Trade Organization rules appeared to point to a multilateral system that is being threatened. The report listed a vast array of U.S. self-serving actions as being the root cause. Some of those actions included blocking appointments to the WTO appellate body, leading to its paralysis, abusing trade remedies and export controls, economic coercion and sanctions, some of which we have covered in this program. One of the measures coming at a cost to China and other WTO members concerns the organization's dispute settlement mechanism. The U.S. has rejected and gone against this mechanism, especially when it comes to tariff measures related to steel and aluminium. Recently, the WTO report regarding China's countermeasures against the United States Section 232 tariff measures related to steel and aluminium emphasized that the root cause of the problem was the unilateral protectionist moves of the U.S. At the same time that China released this report, which seemed to point to the multilateral system to be in jeopardy, the WTO deputy chief stated that multilateral trading system remains unshaken since global production and trade are gradually returning to normal. He did admit that globalization is undergoing a period of adjustment, with some regions and sectors decelerating while others accelerating, a phenomenon he called reglobalization.
As long as there are no large-scale extreme events, global trade is expected to show a trend of steady growth.
Meanwhile, the World Trade Organization Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala said China is driving global economic growth with the success of its multilateral trading system, marked by its efforts to enhance cooperation globally as it is the largest exporter of goods worldwide.
China is probably one of the poster children for the success of the multilateral trading system. Since it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, China has done phenomenally.
And that does it for this Quick Take section.
We reached the end of the program. The U.S., as I'm sure the world is well aware of the fact that it has been trying desperately to stave off, to weaken, and to altogether stop Chinese economic advancement. Many obviously know that. Now, add to that the Chinese military prowess, as evidenced in the anti-chip and semiconductor moves that the U.S. has leveled against China. well, the U.S. is justifying its moves in the spirit of competition. Do you buy that? Well, if not, maybe it's high time that China, while advancing its technology and advancing its economy at the same time, should up the ante by militarily challenging the U.S. Not obviously the thinking that is behind China, but maybe it should do that, and even more so in the U.S.'s backyard, for the U.S. to get a taste of its own medicine. Something to think about, isn't it? That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks so much for tuning in. This program hopefully does add to the U.S.'s destructive policies when it comes to the economy and trade. When we cover Tagli and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Hawaii, United States, Maui County officials released the names of 388 people unaccounted for since the decimating 8th of August wildfires, the first such list to be issued. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. United Press International, UPI, has covered this story and tells us more. Authorities in Hawaii released a list naming 388 people who remain missing in Maui as part of a new strategy to identify victims, as well as survivors, more than 2 weeks after a deadly wildfire ravaged the island. The list, compiled and validated by the FBI, was released in an effort to help emergency personnel identify those who were still unaccounted for, as search teams continued to comb through the smoldering ashes of Lahaina for bodies as the death toll stood at 115. So far, 35 victims have been positively identified and their families notified, while 11 others were identified, but their families have not yet been located, according to officials. Meanwhile, federal investigators verified the first and last names of individuals on the list, along with the phone number of the person who reported them missing. Officials were still trying to validate information for hundreds of others reported missing, but could not immediately say when those names would also be made public. On Friday, 25th of August, Hawaii Governor John Green announced the last evacuation shelter for people displaced by the wildfires was closed down. The evacuees were moved to hotels, vacation rentals, or other living accommodation. Hawaii News Now reported more than 5,000 displaced people are in hotels and housing across the island. We want to thank our partners at the American Red Cross, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the hotel industry, and Airbnb for stepping up during this unprecedented tragedy. Hawaii Governor John Green was quoted as saying, "Only together can we rise up, recover, and bring healing to the Lahaina community." Also on Thursday, the Maui Police Department released the names of 8 more victims in the deadliest wildfire in modern American history that erupted on 8th of August, burning thousands of homes and businesses to the ground and leaving a crush of residents homeless. The deceased have been identified. The partial list of missing persons comes. Perhaps as many as 1,000 islanders remained unaccounted for, county officials said earlier this week, while pledging an extensive search for victims and a complete investigation into the cause of the wildfire, which was still smouldering in some areas. During the fire was 85% contained after burning more than 1,000 acres as firefighters used a helicopter to drop water on hotspots from the air. The cooler fire, meanwhile, was 90% contained and consuming about 202 acres of land, whilst intermittent flare-ups frustrated efforts by firefighters to put out the flames. The Lahaina fire was 90% contained, with about 2,170 acres burnt, whilst the Pulehu, the Kihai fire, was extinguished on 12th of August. Also on Thursday, 24th of August, Maui County sued Hawaiian Electric Industries, Inc., and its subsidiaries, including Maui Electric Company, claiming negligence led to the blaze that caused an estimated $5.5 billion worth of damage. Meanwhile, crews sifting through the devastation with cadaver dogs on Thursday wrapped up their searches of one-story homes and businesses in Lahaina and moved to searching multi-story structures that collapsed in the wildfires. In one glimmer of hope, about 1,732 people who were initially reported missing in the aftermath of the inferno have since been located, Maui County officials confirmed on Thursday. Emergency officials acknowledged that some people on the list likely perished in the flames, but they also remained hopeful that many were still alive and just hadn't checked in yet with family and recovering teams. We're releasing this list of 388 names because we know it will help the investigation, Maui Police Chief John Pelletier said in a video message posted on Thursday. We're also balancing that because we know when this list comes out, it can and will cause pain for some folks. America's national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. Maui County officials released the names late on Thursday, 24th of August, of 388 people unaccounted for since the decimating 8th of August wildfires, the first such list to be issued. However, within a day of its release, more than 100 of those on the list or their relatives came forward to say that they're safe, the FBI confirmed on Friday, 25th of August. Officials told CBS News that it doesn't necessarily mean that those 100-plus have been removed from the list, because that new information still needs to be vetted and confirmed. We're very thankful for the people who have reached out by phone or email, Stephen Merrill, the FBI special agent in charge of Honolulu, said in a news conference. Merrill continued by saying, "As we get someone off of a list, this has enabled us to devote more resources to those who are still on the list." An FBI official said on Thursday that the list is only those who have been validated by having been reported as unaccounted for. They were only deemed validated as long as the following criteria was provided: first and last name, as well as a verified contact number for the person who reported the individual as unaccounted for. The 388 names represented a portion of a broader list of up to 1,100 people reported missing that the FBI said earlier this week it was working to validate. At least 115 people have died in the Lahaina wildfire, but the death toll is expected to rise. Maui County has so far identified 45 of the victims, officials confirmed on Friday. On Thursday, 24th of August, 7-year-old Tony Takafua was confirmed as the first child victim of the wildfire. Takafua's remains, along with remains of three of his relatives, were found in a burnt car near their home, including his mother and his grandparents. Officials have expressed concern that many of the victims of the wildfire are children. Meanwhile, in Friday's news conference, Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson announced that Dario Oliveira has been named as the interim administrator of the Maui Emergency Management Agency, about a week after his previous chief, Herman Andaya, resigned amid criticism for his agency's response to the wildfire that destroyed nearly the entire historic town of Lahaina. Oliveira is the former Hawaii Fire Department chief and also served as the head of the Hawaii County Civil Defense Agency.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an interview, far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said that the right to life and movement for settlers in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank trumped the right to movement for Palestinians. Palestinians have long railed against travel restrictions, including checkpoints imposed on them by Israel in the occupied West Bank. Ben-Gvir, who lives in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, near the flashpoint West Bank city of Al-Khalil, said in the interview the curbs were needed to protect his family's security.
My right, my wife's right, my children's right to move on the roads of Judea and Samaria are more important than the right of movement for Arabs. This is the truth. My right to life tops their right to movement.
The international community, along with the Palestinians, consider settlement construction illegal. More than 700,000 Israelis live in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. Following Ben-Gvir's comments, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned his remarks as racist and heinous and said it only confirms Israel's apartheid regime of Jewish supremacy. Remarks by Ben-Gvir, who has a history of anti-Arab incitement and has long taken a hardline approach to the Palestinians, infuriated some legislators in the Israeli parliament. Arab lawmaker Ahmad Tibi strongly denounced Ben-Gvir, who oversees the police, for his provocative comments.
For the first time, an Israeli minister admits on air that Israel enforces an apartheid regime based on Jewish supremacy.
Karine El-Harar, a lawmaker from the opposition and a former minister, also reacted to Ben-Gvir's provocative remarks, blasting him as the authentic representative of the most racist cabinet Israel has ever had. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court defines apartheid, which is a direct symptom of military occupation, as a crime against humanity, characterized by the commission of inhumane acts such as unlawful killing, torture, and forcible transfer, which are committed to maintain an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another. Major human rights groups and UN officials have accused Tel Aviv of perpetuating such a system against Palestinians on top of the military occupation of their land and a decades-long campaign of genocide. Ben-Gvir, a member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right coalition, has been convicted in the past of inciting racism and of supporting a terrorist organization. More recently, Ben-Gvir has said Israel must kill thousands of Palestinians, called for flattening buildings in the occupied West Bank, and has led multiple raids into Al-Aqsa Mosque. The West Bank has been rocked by violence since early last year, especially with repeated deadly raids by the Israeli army. Israeli forces launch raids on various cities of the West Bank almost on a daily basis under the pretext of detaining what the regime calls wanted Palestinians. The raids usually lead to violent confrontations with residents. Settler attacks against Palestinians and their property are also a regular occurrence. Palestinians in Al-Khalil are particularly vulnerable to settler violence as well as Israeli surveillance. A former Israeli army general has blamed the rising wave of violence in the occupied West Bank on settlers who, as he described, go very wild in terms of provoking the local population, doing terrible acts of vandalism, sometimes terrorism against Palestinian families. The former head of the Israeli Army's Operations Directorate, Israel Ziv, said Israeli settlers are definitely encouraged by what they think is the policy of the Israeli cabinet and the coalition today. The development came after a wave of recent resistance operations in the occupied West Bank. Against the decades-long occupation by the regime, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed this year in the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza, the highest number of fatalities since 2005. The majority of these fatalities have been recorded in the West Bank. At least 30 people have also been killed in Palestinian retaliatory attacks against Israeli settlers during that time.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization. The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies, we are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, a process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran, have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West, could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a seized tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has sat off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report, but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsidi, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal. Iran has warned against the provocative buildup of American forces in the Persian Gulf, saying the move comes at a time when regional countries are improving their relations. Tehran says the security of the region, especially that of the Persian Gulf waterway, must be ensured within the region itself by the Persian Gulf states. In this regard, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman are to form a joint naval force under China's auspices towards enhancing maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is a key strategic strip of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, where near a third of the world's oil flows through. Back in July, the U.S. military announced it has deployed 3,000 sailors and marine forces to West Asia under the pretext of protecting ships and vessels crossing the main waterways in the region. A recently released footage from Iran showed an encounter on August 17th involving the USS Bataan and USS Thomas Hutner. The video footage released by the naval force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, showed Iranian speedboats issuing warnings to a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, forcing the warship to ground its choppers before they can enter Iran's territorial waters. The commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsidi, said his force's success in monitoring maritime movements in the Persian Gulf and their vigilance in the face of threats, particularly from the warships of extra-regional countries, proved that the Iranian forces would never allow enemies to undermine security in this strategic region. Iran has made it clear that it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its national security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly vowed to give a decisive response to any hostile move by Washington that would disrupt the security of the strategic waterway.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahamane Tchiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation, led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdoulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tchiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tchiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger and the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tchiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Many Mo'oi survivors say the U.S. government response to the recent wildfire in the island has been inadequate and slow. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Noted, the recent fire in Hawaii has exposed several issues in the way the U.S. handles wildfires. Weak public awareness in reporting emergencies, failures in local warning systems, insufficient rescue forces, and weak mobilization capabilities. It is truly baffling that the administrator at the Maui Emergency Management Agency decided not to sound warning sirens when a devastating wildfire was ravaging the town of Lahaina. This also reflects the incomplete research, analysis, and consideration of disasters by the Emergency Management Department, analysts told the Global Times. Sadly, this is not the first time that the U.S. government has suffered huge tragedy resulting in mass casualties due to ill-equipped rescue mechanisms and poor rescue capabilities in natural disasters such as fires. In 2018, nearly 10,000 buildings in Paradise Town, California, were destroyed by wildfires. The town was home to 27,000 residents before it was engulfed in flames. About 80 people were confirmed dead, and nearly 1,000, including several Concentrians, were also reported missing, according to British media report on November 20 that year. The then U.S. President Donald Trump declared a state of emergency in California on November 10th. He blamed California's officials for wildfires. He described the situation on social platform. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. In recent years, the U.S. government has not placed as much emphasis on emergency rescue as it did before. By contrast, other developed countries have attached great importance to the development of emergency rescue capabilities. Moreover, these countries normally employ firefighters from local areas who are more familiar with local conditions in emergencies. For example, China has been making persistent top-down efforts in strengthening its comprehensive emergency response system to better tackle a variety of disasters and accidents. In the 2013 to 2021 period, the number of people dead or missing in natural disasters on average each year decreased by 87.2% compared with 2000 to 2012 period in China. China has also accelerated the transformation and upgrading of fire and rescue teams, creating over 3,500 professional teams specializing in water, mountain, and earthquake rescue and other emergency response fields. The slow response and insufficient mobilization capacity displayed by the U.S. government, as seen during many natural disasters and emergencies, have also made some people on the island of Taiwan have mixed feelings about the country's deplendability. On social media, some Taiwan residents called the Biden administration and U.S. Army cold-blooded. If the close-at-hand Moy Island was unable to receive support in time, how can the Tsai administration believe that the faraway U.S. Army would come and rescue Taiwan? One mocked at social media. Natural disasters and the situation in Taiwan Straits are two different things that are incomplete, commented a Chinese mainland research fellow on Taiwan studies. He told the Global Times, nonetheless, the fire has made some Taiwan secessionists realize that the U.S. is not as reliable as they expected. With power outages in the local area and no access to television or radio, residents of Mo'oi were reported to have received no text alerts or television or radio notifications, and that is according to media reports. To make things worse, local residents said that fire hydrants ran out of water, which hindered firefighters' ability to contain the fire. FEMA officials have also confirmed that there was an issue that affected the hydrant's water supply, and that is according to a report by CBS News on August 17th. Alan Decar, a Front Street business owner, said he watched business after business in the historic district goes up in flames, while buildings on both sides of the most important business streets on Mo'oi were engulfed. There were no fire trucks at present time. Hawaii News now quoted Dekar as saying, I think the fire department was overwhelmed. On social media platforms, including TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter, many local residents on Mo'oi and opinion leaders in the U.S. criticized the U.S. government's lackluster rescue efforts. The website of the Federalist also noted, when word reached Biden about the deadly Mo'oi fires that killed over 100 people and left 800 more missing, he didn't rush to Air Force One and fly over the Pacific to the afflicted island. Instead, the 46th President of the United States spent yet another day neglecting his oath of office on a Delaware beach vacation, where he offered reporters no comment about the hundreds of fire victims. After a brief appearance at the White House, where he once again refused to speak with reporters about the catastrophe, Biden jetted off to lunch at Lake Tahoe. The president eventually paused his elaborate stay in Sierra Nevada Mountains to fly to Hawaii. When Biden finally arrived on the ravaged island 2 weeks after the deadliest wildfire in modern U.S. history started, he kicked off the somber visit by cracking several jokes about pavement and football. Biden's babbling only worsened when he turned a speech that was supposed to encourage the fire victims into a self-adulting laced with lies. He topped off his posturing with a quick nap during a service dedicated to honoring the people who lost their lives in Lahaina. Biden's slow, aloof response isn't just an offense to the people of Hawaii, which voted him into office. It's also a stain on his presidency and proves that his leadership is a liability. Leading a nation is not a game. Smoldering ruins are not a stage for the latest round of senile stand-up. And Afghanistan, East Palestine, the border Maui, and every other place recovering from ruin are no places for performative posturing. Hawaii certainly isn't the first time Biden has checked out during a crisis, and it won't be his last.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86 flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. During the period of Tahlavi and Qajar rule, we had no knowledge about the sea and its capacities, despite the country's vast coastal areas and maritime resources. The Navy was preoccupied with other things. Fortunately, you didn't experience those days. There were some fair, honest people who told us what's going on in the Navy back then. There were no signs of these kinds of achievements back then. This accomplishment was presented and provided for our forces by the revolution. So the next lesson was a lesson about the revolution. The revolution saved the sea and seafaring from being put aside and forgotten in Iran. The next lesson from your achievement was your presence which brought security. Your presence in remote areas at the far ends of the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans contributed to the country's security. You proved that the sea belongs to everyone and that the high seas do not belong to certain people. If the superpowers were able to, they would even register the oceans in their own name so that the others would have never access to them. Monopolization of the areas belonging to all humanity is one of the characteristics of the United States and the superpowers. You showed the falseness of this.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, hostile actions were taken against you during this journey to hinder your mission and or to ruin it, but you overcame them. You proved that the high seas belong to everyone. One of the clear results of your work was that you showed that the high seas belong to everyone. They say, we won't allow certain ships to pass through certain straits. Nonsense. Why? The high seas belong to everyone. Everyone should be able to travel through them. People should be able to travel back and forth. The sea and the air must be free for all nations. Security for shipping and maritime transport must be ensured for all countries. Today, the U.S. attacks all tankers and helps maritime smugglers. What they are doing is a major violation. They do this in our region, and we are aware that they are doing this more or less in other places as well. These are violations of an international human law that cannot be disregarded.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Al Bayouk family, who lives in one of the most marginalized areas in southern Gaza Strip, Qizan Rishwan, is the main supporter of the talented son Muhammad as he's pursuing his dream. The 13-year-old boy was elected to participate in the football contest in Tunisia, but his permit to leave the besieged Gaza Strip was denied by the Israeli authorities. But when he managed to leave the region and participated in the tournament, Mohammed did his best for his country.
My son, along with his teammates from the besieged Gaza Strip, got the chance to compete in the Norway Cup finals against four countries with 43 teams. I knew that my son is talented, but I just was able to support him with what was available due to the economic situation in the besieged Gaza Strip. It wasn't easy for me as a father of four to provide food and equipment needed to improve his physical condition and skills. Sometimes I couldn't buy him football shoes due to high prices, so he had to play with low-quality second-hand ones or to borrow from our friends and neighbors.
It was Friday noon and the whole family gathered to watch the match. I was praying for him. It was a tough match, especially in the extra time, and it was my son who scored the golden goal that qualified them for the finals. I was happy for him that he managed to leave Gaza to participate in the Norway Cup, but at the same time, I was concerned for his safety. But thankfully, they came back with the cup, and they raised the Palestinian flag in the world.
The passion for playing football has grown fast, and 2 years ago, he had the chance to sharpen his skills. when he joined the Youth Stores Center, where he used to train with low-quality equipment.
I love football so much. Despite the cancelling of our trip to Tunisia by the Israeli occupation, I made it up to Norway and won the cup, where I scored 5 goals. I wish we had big stadiums like those I played there. Here, I play at the pitches with poor quality. I wish I could join Real Madrid club one day and play like Luka Modric. I wish I could visit Portugal, Spain, France and Denmark. I've shown the whole world that even if we suffer from the Israeli occupation in the besieged Gaza Strip and don't have the chance like other children around the world,